This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm David Kestenbaum. Later in the program, we'll hear how leafhoppers communicate with each other. But first, it's spring. The days are getting longer, it's getting warmer, and if you go out into the backyard and lie down and look into the grass, you will find you're not alone. There are a lot of bugs around this time of year. By one estimate, there are 10 quintillion on the Earth at any moment. That's a one followed by 19 zeros. So like them or not, they're here. Yes, termites eat houses. Yes, mosquitoes spread malaria. Yes, cockroaches hold after-hours parties in the kitchen. But let's not let a few bad apples spoil things. Bugs do a lot of good. One of our guests this hour says that in some ways, it's bugs that run the planet, not us. And if you're wondering about that herd of ladybugs that suddenly showed up in your living room, or the weird thing with nine legs and three eyes you found, call us. This is your opportunity to ask questions about the insects in your life. Maybe one of our bug experts can help you. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website. It's www.sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my first guest. It's Gilbert Waldbauer. He's Professor Emeritus of Entomology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He is also the author of several popular books about bugs. His latest book is What Good Are Bugs, Insects in the Web of Life, just out from Harvard University Press. He joins us by phone from the campus. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Waldbauer.
Thank you.
Are all bugs insects and vice versa? I was wondering about that when we were writing writing stuff to read for today, whether we could use insects and bugs interchangeably.
Well, I use the term bugs as a generic, so I can include spiders and ticks and mites and so forth that aren't really insects in the group. Entomologists usually use the term bug to refer to what they call the true bugs, piercing and sucking things like aphids and leafhoppers, for that matter. But in usual language, it is often used as a broad term that includes all the arthropods. That's all the insects and all their relatives, such as spiders and so forth.
Now, you know, we often hear about, like, a biodiversity crisis, and we usually think about plants and bigger animals. Are insects also suffering a loss?
Oh, yes, they are, especially in the tropical forests, where the great majority of insect species live. The forests are being destroyed at a very rapid rate, and insects are going extinct at a very rapid rate.
And are they covered by the Endangered Species Act? Some of them are, right?
Oh, some of them are, yeah.
How do you decide? I mean, I suppose you get a mosquito, it's going to be hard to muster sympathy.
I don't know of any mosquito on the Endangered Species Act. It's easy to muster sympathy for butterflies.
Right.
For large, spectacular moths, for big, spectacular beetles, like one of the burying beetles that's just on the verge of going extinct in North America, and maybe ladybird beetles and so forth. But hard to get sympathy for many other insects, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about some of these. Your book is What Good Are Bugs. Okay, so what about the mosquito? I mean, go ahead, defend the mosquito.
if
we got rid of them?
There are two good defenses for the mosquito. One is one that everyone will approve of. In the water, there are small fish that are too small to eat bacteria and single-celled algae that float around in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But mosquito larvae in the water eat these things, incorporate them in their bodies, and in that way create a much larger package of food, which of course is the body of the mosquito larva. And then the fish can eat the larva. And in that way, the fish can make use of the bacteria and the one-celled algae. So the larva makes itself into a food package.
Okay.
Now, the other way that a lot of people are going to be unhappy with, but that's something we just have to live with because it's going on, is that mosquitoes help to control the populations of birds and mammals. Now, birds are cute, mammals are fuzzy, but all of them.
Some of my best friends are mammals, you know.
Yeah, we are mammals. all creatures, including people, produce more young than are required to replace themselves.
Are you suggesting we need to be pruned and that's why we should keep the mosquito around?
Yes, exactly. Not us so much. Yeah. I think we're going to have to use other methods. But things like the very, say a robin nests twice in a year, 5 eggs each time, probably lives for 3 years, so it produces 30 eggs. Now, if two of those survive, the robin population stays stable from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
If four survive, the robin population doubles every from year to year. And that could be a catastrophe after 10 or 12 doublings. We would be knee-deep in robins.
Okay, let's take a call. Natalie from Lawrence, Kansas. You're on the line. What's your question?
Hi. Yeah, I recently found a spider in my room, and it was bright red. And it was fairly large, and on its back was a little, was a gray sack. And I was just wondering if this was an egg sack, and if the mother spider carries the babies inside of her abdomen or whatever, or if she deposits it somewhere else.
You sound like someone who maybe is feeling a little guilty. Did you kill the spiders?
Well, I think I ran over it a little bit with my vacuum cleaner, so it was injured, but not quite dead yet, and I put it in a pickle jar. And it passed away in the jar, so I still have it.
Well, you know, spiders are not a bad thing to have in the house because they eat other kinds of insects.
Yeah, I'm not anti-spider. It's just scary.
Yeah, but what you saw is almost certainly a female spider carrying a silken sack in which was enclosed her eggs.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, well, that answers my question.
All right, thanks for your call. Let's take another call. Edmund from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the line. What's your question?
Yes, hi there. My name is Edmund, and I'm a fly fisherman. And I have a natural inclination towards things buggy. And when I heard your show today, I just had to call in and say that we fly fishermen are incredibly interested in bugs, especially those of us who actually tie flies. Because as we're on the river trying to catch trout, we have to be aware on a moment-by-moment basis to the changes in the entomological landscape, if you will. Various flies hatch off and trout key on them and start feeding. And we have to really hopefully have a correct imitation that we have tied or purchased so that we can target the trout. But the life that is going on under the stones and at the bottom of the river is incredibly fascinating. And rather than listeners thinking of bugs as icky and horrible, if they would take some time to roll over stones when they're around a river or a pond, they will find that it's an unbelievably fascinating, incredible world down there. And so I just wanted to offer that comment and perhaps give listeners and yourself a different view from a trout fisherman's perspective.
Okay, thanks very much for your call. Let me introduce the second guest. Tom Turpin is a professor of entomology at Purdue University at Indiana. He is also the co-founder of the Purdue University Bug Bowl, and will give you a different perspective on insects. I believe there is a cricket spitting contest there. He's also the past president of the Entomological Society of America. Dr. Turpin joins us from member station WBAA on the Purdue campus. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Turpin.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on. Can we talk about a little bug news? I understand that scientists have actually revised their thinking about how bugs breathe.
Yes, indeed. Within the last year or so, some scientists at the University of Chicago have sort of revisited the idea of insect breathing. Gilbert and I, for years, have taught that insect respiration and breathing was a very passive kind of a thing, unlike humans that use our diaphragm to help force air in and out. And they've discovered that insects actually work in a very similar fashion.
Now, when you say passive, you mean they just kind of air just circulates in just through normal currents? Or?
Yeah, the idea was that through the spiracles of the insect, which would sort of be the breathing holes, that the air would just sort of move into those holes, and then passively the oxygen would diffuse across the membrane at the end of the trachea, which were tacked to the breathing holes, and the carbon dioxide would diffuse back across it with very little active ventilation or active breathing on the part of the insect.
So do they have lungs? What's this new news?
They don't have lungs, but what is going on apparently is there are some muscles that that are circular around the trachea that contract in a very rhythmic fashion, and that forces the air in and out of the spiracles in the same way that our diaphragm would force the air in and out of our lungs.
Okay, let's take a call.
Could I interrupt?
Let's take a call first. And
okay.
Okay, Richard from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
How you doing today?
Hi, good.
Good. What good are lice, tiggers, and ticks, and I guess other parasites?
Okay, thanks very much.
Are we going to let Gilbert take this one?
Sure, Gilbert. Why don't you go to bat for the ticks?
Sure. Okay.
What good are they for?
Now, the argument is the same as the argument I made for mosquitoes. One is that all of these things can be food for other creatures, and the other is that all of them exert pressure on populations to keep populations down, and that's of everything from other insects to worms to birds to mammals, reptiles, and so forth.
Let's talk about something else you mentioned in your book that was interesting. There's a story about bumblebees, why bumblebees are good.
Well, bumblebees are very good because they pollinate flowers.
But also tomatoes.
Well, there's an interesting story attached to that. People started growing tomatoes in greenhouses many, many years ago. And that was a very expensive proposition because although tomato blossoms self-pollinate, they don't do so unless the blossom is shaken. So they went out and they bought a bunch of vibrators. I don't know where they got them, maybe in the obvious place. And they hired a whole bunch of people to go around the greenhouse with those vibrators, touching those tomato blossoms one by one by one by one. You can imagine what a tomato cost.
Yes.
Well, some guy in the Netherlands finally figured out how to culture bumblebees. That is, how to domesticate them and how to get colonies of them to live in the greenhouse. Now, when a bumblebee lights on a flower to sip nectar or to take up pollen, it is constantly shaking its body. And this, of course, is the equivalent of the vibrator. Now, an interesting thing is that the bumblebee shakes its body probably to call attention to itself. Because its red and white, yellow and black coloration announce the fact that it's something not to be messed with because it can sting, and bouncing around enhances that message.
Okay, let's take a call. Lisa from San Francisco, California.
Yes, my name is Lisa, and I'm calling regarding bumblebees.
Oh, good.
I live in an apartment building, and in our communal storage area down in the basement, bumblebees have, I think they have a little nest down there, and I know how wonderful bumblebees are, but I'm wondering,
have to be wonderful in your house?
Exactly. And should we leave them alone and wait until they do their bumblebee thing, or what should we do?
Okay.
From what you say, I understand they're indoors?
They're wooden planks covering the floor with gaps, and it's sort of a basement area, and they've begun nesting there down below under the house.
Well, I hate to see anybody kill bumblebees, but they sting, and they can have a very bad sting, and in such a situation, I would suggest you get in an exterminator to get rid of them before somebody gets badly stung.
Are they the least aggressive of, say, the bee family?
Gee, I don't know about that. Oh, there are a lot of bees that are far less aggressive. The social bees, like honeybees and bumblebees and so forth, that have big colonies, are particularly aggressive against people and other large animals that might raid the colony to get at the honey and the pollen that they store.
Right.
So bumblebees are particularly aggressive because they're out to protect the colony.
Okay, we got to take a short break, but we'll take lots more of your questions when we come back. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm David Kestenbaum. We're talking this hour about bugs. My guests are Gilbert Waldbauer, Professor Emeritus of Entomology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and the author of What Good Are Bugs? Insects in the Web of Life, just out from Harvard University Press. Tom Turpin is Professor of Entomology at Purdue University in Indiana and the co-founder of the Purdue University Bug Bowl. Let's take a call. David from Minneapolis, you're on the line. You have a question?
Yes, I was wondering if they had found any bugs that do not utilize oxygen.
Okay.
Well, maybe Tom would like to answer that question.
To my knowledge, and I think that Gilbert's passing the buck here on this one. since they're living organisms and basically at some point utilize oxygen, I do not know of any that do not use oxygen in support of life. Some use more than others, and others obviously can get by with a little bit less. But to my knowledge, we haven't discovered any that can get along without oxygen.
I mean, if you find one and stick it inside a little Tupperware container, I guess there's enough air getting in there. But
as far as I know, only bacteria can get along without oxygen, and that's only some bacteria.
I see.
The truth is, and this is a very good question, that a lot of insects can utilize minimum amounts of oxygen. That's the reason people are very surprised at times when they would have insects enclosed in a Tupperware container and for a long period of time and realize later on that they're still alive. So they're minimum oxygen users, and they can slow their metabolism down to the point where they use very, very little in the times of when they're hibernating.
Okay.
Yeah, an interesting thing about some of those insects that utilize very little oxygen is that many of them have hemoglobin in their blood, the same red pigment that we have in our red blood cells that hangs onto an oxygen molecule and carries it around.
Yeah, I'd always imagined they also had lungs, but apparently I was wrong on that, too.
I beg your pardon?
I always imagined they had little lungs, too, but I guess I was wrong on that one.
Totally different system that they use, David, and that's one of the reasons I suspect that people find them so foreign.
Yeah.
Is you look at the totally different approach to life that they use in many aspects of survival.
Okay, thanks, David. Let's take another call. Bill from Sacramento, you have a question?
Yes, I have two what appears to be black ants. They have two large wings that seem to be straight. They're straight back, and they fly short distances. Now, they don't appear to live too long, and I'm wondering, I have put some organic plants out there with some organic compost. My question is, what are they, where do they come from, and how do I get rid of them? They don't seem to live too long. I wonder if you could describe maybe what they are for me.
Well, I feel like this is a car talk, bug talk version.
Yeah.
It sounds like a similar thing, doesn't it? Gilbert, you can correct me on this one if I'm wrong, but the black ants generally, or at least the sizable ones, are many times carpenter ants, and the winged forms that you see are probably the reproductives. This time of year in many parts of the country, you have the ant colonies reproducing. The males and females with wings are flying around and mating, and then they're going to establish a new colony. Interestingly, if they happen to be males, you see, they have a very short life. As soon as they mate, their biological role in life is done, and they end up dying, which might explain why they seem not to live too long. But if they are carpenter ants, I would be a little interested in where their home nest might be. If it happens to be in the structure, that may mean that some help might be needed, although wouldn't be an immediate necessity.
Did you say carpeting or carpenter ants?
Carpenter ants.
Oh, carpenter ants.
Yeah, and there is
no carpeting in that room.
No, carpenter, as the guy who saws wood.
Oh, okay.
And they're called carpenter ants because they hollow out their tunnels and nests in wood, dead wood usually. I think dead wood always. And they may be tunneling out something in some of the wood in your building.
Oh, okay. There wouldn't be termites, would they?
Oh, no. And they don't do anywhere near the damage that termites do because they don't eat the wood. And termites are constantly doing more and more tunneling because they want to eat the wood.
Okay. They're clustered around a metal door, which is a sliding door, so there's no wood or anything near there. That's what's strange.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, Bill. Tom Turpin, I want to know about the cricket spitting.
Yeah, the cricket spitting is one of the major activities that we have at our bug bowl each year. This year was a difficult year for cricket spitting. We were spitting into the wind, David. And you know, when you spit into the wind, new records aren't set. We had a lot of folks that were very game and trying. And in fact, we had a few people who actually got the cricket up into the wind and lost ground.
Oh, negative yardage.
Negative yardage. It's a very difficult thing for a cricket spitter to have that happen to them. But
have you thought about moving into a stadium or something?
Well, we're looking for a dome stadium. Right now, though, the big donors, the big industries out there just seem like they aren't coming forward to want the stadium named after them. So we're still looking for that company that would like to have their name on a cricket spitting arena.
How far can you spit a cricket?
Well, my best bid is around 27 feet, but I'll have to admit that was with the wind.
The tailwind, yeah.
That was with the tailwind. It wouldn't have qualified for the Guinness record book because of the additional help I was getting from Mother Nature.
They do not keep track of cricket spitting.
Yes, they do. The cricket spitting is now a Guinness world record. In fact, the world record holder actually established, was our holder of the record here, and it was established on their show 3 years ago. So we do have a Guinness World Record.
Okay, let's take a call. Theo from San Jose, California. You have a question?
Yes, thank you. I lived in Yosemite for a while and had ladybugs. I was up hiking one day, had ladybugs just pouring out of Tenaya Canyon, following the river down, and I had heard that there might be a trigger that would cause that migration all at once. I was trying to figure out if I could go up and have that cool experience again, be it like a full moon or a long day, you know, longest day or something, and didn't know if those gentlemen would know.
Yeah, what time of year was that?
I can't really remember. It's been probably 8 to 10 years, probably springtime. But I remember again hearing that there was probably something in the time of the year or a day, kind of like the grunion, you know, spawning all at once or something, but I didn't know if maybe I could pin that date again and give it a shot.
Was it just a cloud of them? I mean, a huge...
Yeah, I mean, it was a slightly windy day. I was sitting right next to the river, and the ladybugs were just swarming out of the hills, out of the mountains.
Wow.
And when a breeze would come up, they would just kind of a light all over the rocks and all over me, and at one time you could probably have 50 to 100 just kind of pop onto you. As soon as the wind would die down, they'd take off again, and I think it was probably only a 1 or 2 day event.
Well, ladybirds go from the valleys up into the mountains to spend the winter, and they get together in huge aggregations. Which
ladybugs, right?
Pardon me?
Ladybugs, not
ladybugs, ladybird beetles, you know,
okay.
It's all the same thing.
Okay.
And they leave those places in spring as soon as their diapause, which is sort of a form of hibernation, is ended, and they immediately fly down to the valley where they can find food and also get away from these hundreds or even thousands of competitors that are all around them. Hmm. Now, that brings up a very interesting point. If you get a gardening magazine, you may see that somebody's going to try to sell you a quart of ladybird beetles for $50 or something like that.
Sure, absolutely.
And they're guaranteed to do good in your backyard. Well, they'll tell you you can keep them in the refrigerator and they'll last for a long time. Well, that means they are still in their hibernating state. And if you release them in their backyard, in your backyard, the first thing they will do when they warm up and come out of hibernation is to fly off. Maybe 2 or 3 miles. So you're not doing any good by buying those ladybird beetles and letting them go in your backyard. You're doing good maybe to some of your neighbors.
Okay, useful knowledge there. Thanks, Theo. Let's take another call. Keith from Aurora, New York. You have a question.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, I moved into a home previously owned by a major gardener. So she was, of course, a huge fan of every kind of Hymenoptera and bee and wasp you could possibly imagine for the benefits of pollination. Well, I'm one of those individuals, and there's probably a lot of people out there listening who are like me, who have an absolute terrifying, shutting down, irrational fear of stinging insects. I see a wasp, I'm on the ground. And I think it's remarkable how much power these little half-inch individuals can have over a 6-foot-tall, 200-pound man. It got so bad that I had to go to Lowe's. I purchased some screen and some 30-mil plastic, made myself a bee suit, bought more chemicals than God, and ended up killing as many as I could.
Oh, no.
I had to pull my shutters out of my house. We found, ultimately, almost 350 major paper wasp colonies on the exterior of my home.
Okay. Dr. Waldbauer, do you hear a lot of stories like this?
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Your fear is really irrational unless you happen
As
to
he
be
said.
Allergic to the stings. Are you allergic to the stings?
Believe it or not, because of my fear, I've never been stung.
Well, the chances are you're not allergic.
Probably not.
And I've been stung by just about every stinging insect there is. And some of them hurt quite a bit, but, you know, it's, you know, nothing, no great big deal. they're not really going to hurt you very much. Now, that is not true if you step into an underground nest of yellow jackets, for example, and there may be hundreds of female workers in there.
We probably don't need a worst-case scenario for Keith.
Yeah, that's the worst-case scenario. Hundreds of workers will...
Well, what do you recommend to do with the, you know, with if for someone who's that, you know, who's that afraid and the fear is real?
The fear is real.
So what do you do?
Well, one thing you could do is try to get some counseling to get rid of the fear. The other thing to do is quite sane. Exactly what you've done is to make a bee-proof suit, because I think insecticides would not be a permanent solution. You'd have to keep repeating and repeating and repeating.
You could destroy the nests at least and make things better, yeah?
Yeah, but then somebody else will come in and build another nest.
This is Tom Turpin, and yeah, I think one of the things that we always talk about in a situation like that, and Gilbert mentioned it, the possibility of getting stung is really quite limited if you leave them alone. Generally, even the paper wasps that we're talking about here are very defensive of their nests, but outside of that little area, unless they individually are molested, normally they're not going to create much of a problem. So it's a matter of basically being calm, cool, and collected in their presence, and probably won't get stung.
I got to say, I don't think that's going to help Keith, though.
It probably won't help Keith, but he can start working on that a little bit, you know, and begin to kind of reach a truce with those paper wasps.
What do you think, Keith?
Remarkable how powerful they are, and I fully recognize that it's about as irrational a fear as it gets.
Okay, all right, well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk about another little bit of news. There was a new order of insect discovered sometime last year, right?
Yeah, made
is that a big deal?
Made a lot of press, at least.
I mean, order is one of the sort of higher up on that little chain, which means it's a whole distinct category we didn't know about, right?
Exactly, and scientists over the years have argued about how many orders there really are, and Gilbert, I don't know whether he ascribes to one group or another, but... the fact is that generally they agreed that they were of this list of orders, and now all of a sudden we've got an insect that doesn't fit into any of those, and so a new order is established. And that's
it's called the gladiator. It's called the
common name is the gladiator. Was what they actually by description said it's sort of a combination between what we think of as the praying mantids and the walking sticks. And, in fact, as I remember the initial report on that, they'd found it in some of the Baltic amber as much as 50 million years ago, hadn't really found it in the wild until just recently, and now that they know where to look, they can find them fairly commonly, and so that's kind of an exciting find, really.
I'm David Kestenbaum, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call. Pete from San Antonio, you have a question?
Yeah. Hello, gentlemen. This is Pete. I run an outdoor education program, and occasionally I see on the ground what at first appears to be that somebody had spray painted on the ground, but on closer inspection, it is thousands and thousands of tiny, way smaller than a flea, insects. And it's just been killing me to find out what they are.
Any takers?
Gilbert, where are you?
I'm in San Antonio near the, about halfway between San Antonio and Austin in the hill country.
Are they really tiny, tiny, tiny?
Tiny, tiny. I have never been able to actually, isolate just one.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, they are really small. But it looks like somebody had just taken a spray paint can and drawn on the ground. And at first I thought our place had been vandalized, and then I looked and they were...
Wow.
They were tiny little critters.
Well, Tom may have a better idea than I do, but
sometimes Gilbert, have a go.
Springtails get in such groups.
Springtails?
Yeah.
Also called Calimbula.
Yeah.
And they are one of these kind of wingless insects that have a little spring device on their end, and that they kind of hop or bounce or spring along, and that's where their name comes from.
Oh, yeah. If you disturb them, they jump. A lot.
Aha, Gilbert, you're on to it here.
Yeah,
this really is a lot like
it.
Car talk.
Yeah, and you know they do come out in great numbers at various times and would form. I can believe your description of looking like somebody had actually spray painted things there. So I think maybe the columellar springtail is a good answer.
Wow. I'm so happy that you told me. I have one other question if I have time.
Sure, go ahead.
Is it true many of my students have told me that daddy long legs have the most potent venom, but they can't bite you? And I don't know anything about daddy long legs except that I have a lot of them. And is it true that they are in fact venomous? And what do they eat anyway?
Well, they eat insects, and they have a venom, but I have no idea of how potent it is, and I can't imagine one ever biting a human.
No, I've never heard of that either, but the kids always tell me they're the most poisonous, but they can't bite.
I've heard that. I've heard that too. Dr. Turpin, is it
yes.
true?
Yes. Well, actually, we have a fellow on the staff here who works with the arachnids that includes the granddaddy long legs, and his comment is that that is absolutely not true. And in fact, that even though they do have a poison, some of them maybe have a poison, they do not have mouth parts that would allow them to bite you, even if they wanted to. It is now we would call I used to call an old wives' tale, and we can't do that anymore. I guess this is an urban myth.
Or suburban legend.
Suburban legend absolutely not true.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. And thank you, David.
Sure, and thanks for your call. Okay, we're going to have to take a break. Dr. Wahlbauer, I understand you have to leave. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Gilbert Wahlbauer is Professor Emeritus of Entomology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author of What Good Are Bugs? Insects and the Web of Life. It's published just out by Harvard University Press. When we come back, we'll take more of your questions and hear some sounds of the mighty treehopper. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm David Kestenbaum. But now, listen to this sound. Hippopotamus? Nope. Brontosaurus? Nope. Whale? No. That's an insect that's about the size of a grain of rice. It's called a treehopper. We're talking about bugs this hour. My guest is Tom Turpin, professor of entomology at Purdue University. And we are now also joining me to talk about the communications of that insect is Randy Hunt. He's a professor of biology at Indiana University Southeast. He joins me by phone from the campus in New Albany, Indiana. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Hunt.
Thank you.
What was that we were listening to?
That is, as you said, a small tree hopper. It's actually fairly common. It's an Incanopa binotata. It's sometimes called the two-line tree hopper. It's really common on redbud in the eastern United States. It's a member of, like all tree hoppers.
How big? These guys are really small, right? I mean, are they like in my yard, you know, if I live in suburbia?
Yeah, they're everywhere. They go unnoticed largely. Really, we're talking about, we have some, what you'll hear in a minute, we have some leaf hoppers, and that was a tree hopper. Leaf hoppers are not as familiar, they're rather dull, but if you just think of walking through your yard and all the little things you see jumping and flying little short flights through the grass, those are all leaf hoppers. And there are hundreds of species of those. They're incredibly abundant and diverse.
Right. I think we probably have a picture on our website. You can see them. They look pretty familiar.
Mm-hmm.
A typical lawn can have 20 species or something of
them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They cause problems, right? That's why you study them?
Tree hoppers generally don't cause too much of a problem, but some species of leaf hoppers cause a lot of problems. Many of them transmit plant pathogens, viruses, bacteria, and so forth. So they get quite a bit of attention.
Now, how did you record these things?
Well, that's we hear these over the radio and amplified. It seems like something you might hear at night, or some sound like whales or so forth. But these are really something you could never actually hear without special equipment. These are vibrational signals that are transmitted through the plant. And so what you just heard was an attraction call of a male, and basically vibrates its abdomen. It sends the vibrations through its legs into the plant and so forth. And we use various equipment to pick up those vibrations and change them into a sound that we can hear.
I mean, give me a picture of how you do it. You actually go outside and sort of get down on your hands and knees?
We do it in the field and in the lab. We have colonies we raise, but we do a lot of work in the field as well, so we have portable equipment we can take out. Probably the simplest way to record this kind of vibration is really an old-style phonograph cartridge. I'm talking way back, early 60s, 50s. The old crystal cartridges are very sensitive to vibrations. and we simply can rest the old phonograph cartridge on a branch or even on a leaf and pick up the vibrations, amplify them, then simply record it on a tape deck and bring it back to the lab, use a computer to analyze it and measure things. That's one way. We use a little more sophisticated approach now. It's a laser that we can use. We can train a laser Doppler vibrometer, it's called, on a plant and actually pick up the vibrations without touching the plant.
Wow.
Which is kind of a fun thing to do.
So why do the insects transmit this way instead of through the air?
Well, that's a good question, really. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with size. These are generally small insects. And a small object, in terms of sound production, it's difficult to produce a loud signal that can travel through the air. So a reasonable alternative is to direct that energy into the plant. And plants carry these vibrations very well. These things can communicate with each other over a meter through a shrub. Incredibly small vibration, but travels really well through a plant.
And that's because the plant is sort of rigid, the same way that whales can communicate really long distances because the ocean's more dense than air.
Very similar.
Okay. All right, so let's play the first sound. You can kind of dance to it.
Yeah, we have a variety of sounds here. Some of them are very melodic and almost sound like whales. This is a very rhythmic one. And this is what you just heard is called Graminella nigrifrons, and that's probably one of the most common leafhoppers in the eastern United States. Everyone has this in their backyard in the summer. And it's also one of the ones that transmits a particular plant virus to corn.
Can you translate for us what it's saying?
Actually, I can. It's a lot of what we do is try to figure out what these sounds mean. And the way we do that, we do playback experiments. So we can record these and use a computer to change them, manipulate them, play it to a female and see how she responds, what part of the signal is important in communication, and so forth. As it turns out, a lot of that rhythm actually has to do with communication to other males. It's kind of surprising to us that these hoppers do some things, not unlike what frogs do or some insects like crickets and katydids, that actually there's male-male competition and they actually chorus. In this species, if we had two or three males, you'd find that they exchange signals. They alternate and take turns calling. And a lot of that rhythm has to do with saying, hey, I'm calling right now. Don't call until I'm done.
Is there any male-male romance?
Well, no, not that we found yet.
What okay, and what was and the sound at the end, was that also, it sort of changed in the middle?
It's a three-part call, and you heard that snorting initially, and we have not found a function for that. It could be just sort of a warm-up phase, and then that highly repetitive bum-bum part in the middle is sort of the main part of its call, and then it simplifies at the end, and that's what you heard, that transition. And what's going on there basically is that middle, highly rhythmic part is sort of a main call to females. The last part also females will respond to, but it sort of has a better, there's more of a gap between those signals. And our work suggests that during that part, a male will shut down if another male starts to call during that. So he can actually respond to another male during that last part, which kind of slows down. But it's sort of the middle part. When he starts, that's it. He goes.
So is that basically like, I'm over here on branch 5, come on down? You know.
Exactly. Only in this case, the female sits still. And if she responds with her signal, he'll breaks loose, and the male will start running around on the plant until he locates the female.
Oh, so after that, if she responds, he goes crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can she hear, if she's anywhere on the plant? Or, I mean, if she's on the next plant, forget it, right? They're never going to be.
Well, it's kind of, this hasn't been studied much, but what's kind of amazing, even say like in a lawn, it's these signals actually, you would think that on a blade of grass, it would be sort of restricted to that blade, but the signals travel pretty well through the turf. So they can easily communicate, say, 2-3 feet across a lawn, which is quite amazing. These things are about you know, eighth of an inch.
Right. Okay. Let's play the next sound. How do they physically make that?
Well, that's a good question, and it's really not clear. I mean, generally, some have what's called a timbal structure. You can imagine a rigid membrane with some like reinforcing rods, that such that when it gets pulled on, it pops, almost like taking like a soda can and pressing your finger on the top and on the metal, and you get pop, pop, pop like that.
Right.
But it's not clear at all. Now, that clearly probably doesn't use a timbal mechanism. It simply vibrates its abdomen. But amazingly, no one's really studied it that much. But they probably use a variety of mechanisms to produce these vibrations.
I'm David Kestenbaum, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, let's hear the next sound.
Okay.
What's that?
That is the glassy-winged sharpshooter. That's a species we've just started working on. The listeners in California.
Another leafhopper.
Oh, another leafhopper. Yeah, it's actually a very one of the larger leafhoppers. This can about a half an inch. It's very large for
huge.
A hopper. Huge for a hopper.
Yeah.
But these are really an emerging pest in California. They attracted to and live on grape plants and a whole variety of other hosts. And they transmit a bacterium to grape, which causes a disease called Pierce's disease, and they're a huge problem in Southern California. So we're trying to work on their mating system and trying to understand how they communicate and so forth. But it's that's another example of a hopper that has sort of almost a haunting, whale-like sound. Suppose the more rhythmic one we heard earlier.
It's amazing. I mean, a lot of these look pretty similar, although that one, I guess, is big. And they make completely different sounds.
Oh, yeah. And what's fun, I mean, this really hasn't been studied a lot. And there are probably 10,000 species of just leafhoppers, and I would say we only know about what maybe 20 of them sound like. So it's kind of fun when you bring a new guest into the lab and put them on a plant, and you get to hear what they sound like for the first time.
A new guest.
Yeah, new guest.
All right, so this last sound, I have to warn, let me just warn listeners, it sounds a bit like a leafhopper leaning on a really annoying car alarm.
Yeah.
All right, here it comes.
I hear that one in my sleep. That is a leafhopper that's a specialist on honey locust trees, and we're working with that right now. It's attended by ants. It has a mutualistic relationship with ants, and we're looking at the possibility whether they use that signal not only for mating but possibly to attract ants. It's kind of an interesting system, but that's one of the more not so melodic but very very grating kind of sound.
Well, you wouldn't have any trouble finding a mate of your species, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pretty distinct.
Yeah, and that's the main, you know, function of these is they're mating signals, and it's what they use to avoid mating mistakes. So they have very distinct signals.
What do you learn about these? I mean, could you play something like this and they would all think there's some huge male and they would never hook up or something? You know.
Oh, well, you know, a lot of our work's very basic. It's not really looking for ways to control. Although I would say for this project with this glassy-winged sharpshooter, what we're trying to do is to see if we can use vibrations to augment sticky traps or so forth that might help jazz them up and improve how sticky traps work in an effort to monitor populations and so forth, because apparently monitoring this insect in problem areas in California has been a little difficult. So there are some applied potential for using these signals, and we're going to give that a try. But most of our work's basic. We're interested in just understanding how what these signals mean and how they function.
All right, that sounded like a car alarm, and we have a caller with a question about a car. Okay. Rebecca from San Diego.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My roommate was at work the other day, and she has a fairly brand new car, and she looked out the window, and her coworker informed her that a swarm of bees was on her rear window, and that she wasn't parked by a tree or anything, and she was scared to go to her car, got on the freeway, did about 70 to get them off, and they were clinging to her window. And the only way she can get them off was by going through a car wash.
Okay. Dr. Turpin, can we get a really quick answer to this?
Yes. That obviously is a honeybee swarm. I just came from the office today, and there's one outside our window over there. This is the honeybees going to establish a new colony, and they land one time as they're looking for a nice hollow limb, and they'll hang around there until they find that, and then they fly off. This is how people make bee beards. They will put that queen on their person, on their chin, and let them gather there. So you're watching the reproduction of a social insect, a honeybee.
On a car bumper. Okay.
On a car bumper.
Thanks very much. I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Tom Turpin, professor of entomology at Purdue University. Randy Hunt is professor of biology at Indiana University Southeast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Earlier, we spoke to Gilbert Waldbauer, author of What Good Are Bugs? Insects in the Web of Life. Thanks to all of you for joining me today. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have questions or comments, write to us at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 36th floor, New York, New York, 10020. You can also send us email, scifry@npr.org, our website, www.sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in New York, I'm David Kestenbaum.